We should note that subsequent to my conversations with the two investigators on this program, TAS 102 was approved for use in advanced colorectal cancer. I next met with Dr. Heinz Joseph Lentz, and to begin our conversation, he presented a patient from his practice.
Hispanic gentleman who had blood per rectum, saw the primary care physician, also some discomfort with the bowel movements, and his physician referred him for a scope which showed a rectal mass at, I think, about 6 centimeters when we collect right. And he was sent to us. We worked him up with an endoscopic ultrasound and CT scans. And our endoscopic ultrasound staging was a T3N1 at 5 centimeters. So we started him with a standard of care treatment option with radiation and capecitabine, which he received. He had some rectal discomfort and some skin erosions with the radiation, but otherwise did well. And after 6 weeks finishing the chemo radiation treatment, he underwent an APR. The pathological staging at this time was a T2NO, so we decided to use 4 months of a modified FOLFOX6 regimen, which he received, no dose-limiting toxicities. We followed him up according to the guidelines every 3 months for the first 2 years and once a year CT scan. And about in his first CT scan after 1 year, he showed lesions in the left upper lung. I think there were about 3 lesions. Now, when we go back to the CT scan, we saw that this small change in the lung were present. So this lung lesions grew by 1 or 2 millimeters. So we were not 100% sure, and it was below the detection sensitivity of the PET. So we did a VATS, took one out, wanted to know if it's cancer, and it confirmed it was actually colorectal cancer. We did on this sample the mutation analysis on KRAS, and it was actually a KRAS mutation. So we treated him with FOLFIRI-bevacizumab. And the first CT scan shows that the lesions were the same size, maybe the size the same, but there seems to be essential necrosis in these lung lesions. So we decided after 3 months of treatment that we would like to have our thoracic surgeons again involved to see if this can be removed. And he decided that this was well controlled and could be removed, and he underwent a resection. The resection came back that this was still metastatic adenocarcinoma, but with significant necrosis of 50 to 60%. After he recovered from surgery with no postoperative complication, we decided to give again 3 months of the same treatment we did prior with FOLFIRI-bevacizumab, which often creates a lot of discussion. How can you do that? You have to do FOLFOX. But from my conviction, if this treatment led to the removal of metastatic disease, we are treating metastatic disease and I use the same chemotherapy regimens. Since then, he is closely monitored with CT scan every 3 months and so far has not recurred. So I think he has a good chance to be cured with aggressive chemotherapy and surgical intervention.
Obviously, there's a huge literature on management of liver-only mets. What do we know about lung-only mets?
Yeah, and I think that's the reason I think this example is a good one, that we do not just think when you have pulmonary lesions alone that this not be resectable. The problem with the lung, in the majority of cases, you have bilateral disease, and that makes this approach, of course, more complicated. But not impossible either. So I think the major message, and there are data from René Adam's group and other Europeans, that lung-limited disease have also a chance for potential curative resections, depending, of course, on the size, the location, and the number of the metastatic sites. But I can only encourage people and oncologists and colleagues to really look at lung-limited disease to see if there is any treatment opportunities and a window to surgically remove we have experience where we have bilateral lung mets, where we went after one, treated, and then resected on the other side.
So I think you were referring to the fact that when you gave the post-op FOLFIRI bevacizumab, I guess it's more of the problem with the bevacizumab, knowing that the adjuvant trials were negative. What's your thinking?
Yeah, I think what we may be commonly mistaken compare is adjuvant treatment after a primary tumor resection versus adjuvant treatment after a metastatic site removal. I don't think it's the same. Biology, cancer cells which spread, are not the same than residual disease of a primary tumor. So I think we do not have prospective data proving it, but in my personal practice, I use systemic treatment like for metastatic disease, even when they're resected, in the same way I did in the neoadjuvant setting.
You mentioned the central necrosis seen in response to anti-angiogenic agents. Any comments on what we know about this?
I think there is a lot of data out that when you see with anti-VEGF treatments that central necrosis is an indicator of response. Now, there are actually very recent data who looked for the patients who have essential necrosis to see if their outcome is different. And it is. It's better. So I think we know that when you have an effect of against anti-angiogenic treatment with essential necrosis, these are patients who respond, and they seem to do better in PFS and overall survival, actually documented in the CORRECT trial. So I think this is very important that when you look at your report, or better, look at the films, that the same size does not necessarily mean you don't have a response to treatment or any tumor shrinkage. It may be a necrosis which is not captured by the size alone.
I kind of wonder whether or not that lung cancer bevacizumab has been associated with hemoptysis. And initially there was talk about central cavitation. Do you ever see hemoptysis in patients with lung mets from, say, colon cancer receiving bevacizumab or anti-angiogenic therapy?
Yeah, I think the difference is that with the lung cancer patients, you have essential mass eroding blood vessels with a response to treatment. I think it's a part of the response. Unfortunately, the erosion of the major blood vessels close by, of course, a life-threatening complications. And we don't see that in the peripheral mets of colon cancer.
This also, I guess, leads into the issue of liver-only mets, as I was mentioning. I'm curious what your approach right now is, first of all, to a patient who presents with easily resectable liver met. Do you send him to surgery or give him pre-surgical chemotherapy or systemic treatment?
Yeah, so I think that's probably also a personal bias. But my approach is that if it's resectable and it's more than 2 centimeters in size, I do neoadjuvant treatment for a couple of different reasons. First of all, it's a wonderful opportunity to see if your drug works. Because in the adjuvant setting, you're always caught in the dilemma, what do you do and do you know if it works? That's one. Second is, when you see a lesion, is that really all the disease which is present or not? In other words, is this the tip of the iceberg and are there microscopic diseases you may miss? So I would like to see a very good control of a disease before I do a surgery. And their data are very well established when you, after 3 months, you have stable or shrinking disease, that the success of a curative intended surgery is much better. If the lesion is smaller than 2 centimeters, I'm just afraid it goes away and the surgeons cannot take it out. And that creates more headaches for me than just take it out and treat in the adjuvant setting. But I think not everyone follows the same guidelines or the same strategies, because many do the resection when it's resectable. I don't think we know today what the better strategy is. I'm just, from biology, like a little bit more mine, otherwise I probably wouldn't do it, that I don't think we are missing anything. And I think we can justify the use of biologics so much easier with potential more benefit. I think that is probably the best scientific and medical rationale.
So I guess a related question, I think I can guess the answer based on how you manage this patient with the lung mets, is post-operative pseudo-adjuvant therapy. Do you use it? And the real question, because I think a lot of people use it, is whether you use a biologic. We've seen a real split on that. Based on your lung case, it looks like you use it with a biologic.
Yeah. You know, I think for me, it's very easy. When the drug combination works, I use the same. I think sometimes I'm caught in the dilemma, particularly when the lesions are removed and does not show any necrosis. So if I don't see any more the benefit of treatment, even when the tumor may have shrunk from 5 to 3 centimeters, but there is no more necrotic effect, is this still the right treatment to continue? And here I'm struggling what I should do. And I don't think I have the real answer. We know from the sarcoma field, when you don't see the tumor necrosis, you switch chemotherapy. So I have switched in the past, but I'm always struggling with decision. And I include, of course, in the discussion, the patient understanding what the dilemma are and what are the issues. But this is more the difficulty than the ones who respond and continue with the same.
So one final question about liver-only mets. The uncommon but important situation of a patient who needs a response in order to go to surgery. The surgeon tells you it's near a blood vessel, et cetera. They want to see it shrunk down. And a patient with a RAS wild-type tumor, what do you do?
Actually, in a RAS wild-type, I do FOLFOX and cetuximab. The data are very convincing and consistent in the literatures. I'm a little bit surprised in the US. I think we are a very exceptional country. Around the world, this is more kind of the standard, and here it's still the exception. I'm not sure what that is linked to. Maybe the involvement of our colorectal surgeons are not in the same than it's the rest of the world, because often they do the treatment in Europe and in Asia. But I do the EGF receptor because the response rate have been over 70% very consistently. Now, in a mutant, that actually is a different issue. And here I use the FOLFOXIRI-bevacizumab combination. So I do that very clearly. For mutant, I use a more comprehensive cytotoxic backbone, which has been shown in the TRIBE dataset. And I use bevacizumab. And in the wild type, I use a cetuximab combination. I prefer the FOLFOX, okay? Because also, again, when you rule out any mutant, you don't have an interaction with the oxaliplatin sensitivity, and they show very high response rate.
So another question, I actually asked Charlie this, but it's so important. I want to ask you also, in terms of late line disease, in terms of colorectal cancer, now we're hearing about a new agent, TAS-102. Regorafenib has been out there for a couple of years. I'm curious, first of all, what you think about TAS-102. Do you think it's going to become available? And if it does, how do you think you're going to utilize it, if at all, in your practice?
Yeah, so I think we are in a very good position now to have different treatment options in a refractory patient population. We have regorafenib, and I think TAS-102 will be approved in the next couple of months in fall this year in the US. It's already approved in Japan. I think it has a very novel mechanism of actions, and it is distinct. And I think that's a very important information for any of our colleagues, because it works even when 5-FU, a capecitabine, will not work, because the mechanism is different. Now, an interesting side effect, which a lot of people do not know, it's also DBD independent. So patients who have DBD insufficiency or issues can be treated with TAS-102. So I think it is a very effective drug, shown with very convincing hazard ratio on PFS and overall survival. I think the biggest question will be in the clinic for patients who fail the standard of care treatment options: what do I use first, regorafenib or TAS-102? And I think it will all come down to the side effect profile, because side by side, very difficult to see or state what is more effective. So both are oral medications, but both have different side effect profiles. TAS-102, much more on the bone marrow suppressive, leukopenia, anemia, thrombocytopenia. and the regorafenib much more on the patient side of fatigue, skin toxicity. So I think it needs to be individually discussed what is the preferred option for the patient who sit in front of you.
Have you used the drug?
Yes, we have the access program and we were part of the phase 3.
What is the issue with myelosuppression? How often is it a clinical issue? How often do you have to hold therapy?
I don't think it happens as often we would be afraid of. It is not a major clinical issue. Patients tolerate this drug very well. In fact, in the placebo-controlled trial, from the patient, I was not necessarily able to say who is on the drug or not, only when I see the CBC. Now, that doesn't mean the hemoglobin goes down to 7 and very bad. It's just a drop, usually, of a grade 2 anemia or grade 1 leukopenia or grade... So it usually does not interfere with infusion or treatment-related interventions necessary for this patient population.
So you mentioned the mechanism of TAS-102, and I'm going to put my medical school brain back on. Maybe you can take us back through the pathways.
Well, I think one of the biggest interesting issues is that TAS-102 interferes with the DNA synthesis, okay, in a different way. And it's not driven by thymidinated synthase like 5-FU is. So it is incorporated in the DNA through its metabolite and therefore interrupts DNA replication. But one of the most interesting distinction between 5-FU is the inhibition of thymidine phosphorylase. Now, thymidine phosphorylase was reported as one of the mechanisms of resistance to 5-FU when it's high. Now, thymidine phosphorylase has two major activities. One, in the fluorouridine pathway to phosphorylase thymidine, but it's also an angiogenic factor. So this TAS-102 may have actually an anti-angiogenic effect through the inhibition of TP, which is a mechanism of resistance to 5-FU. So I think the mechanisms are very distinct from the fluoropyrimidines we have so far. It may not cause the same toxicity linked to DBD, and it may also have a very interesting anti-angiogenic effect.
But there are two molecules in the product, correct?
Yes.
What are they?
So there are two metabolites falling apart. And I think that's one of the problems a little bit with the approval, because whenever we have two components in it, it's very difficult to approve within the U.S. These components have different mechanisms of actions. One is actually doing the interference with the integration into the DNA and inhibiting the DNA replication. And the other one will inhibit the metabolization of the active metabolite. So it's a very complex, I don't want to go into too details because it's you will forget it anyway, but I think it's very important that there are two active compounds, that these compounds have a novel mechanism of actions which do not overlap with the fluoropyrimidines and have a unique impact on DNA replication and potential anti-angiogenic effect.
Now, is this a fluoropyrimidine?
Well, it interferes with the fluoropyrimidine pathway.
Interesting. Before we go into your last case, or maybe we can just even hold on that, because I wanted to talk to you a little bit about GIST and GINET, and first ask you in general how you manage your patients both in the adjuvant setting as well as the metastatic setting with GIST.
Yeah. So the adjuvant setting is pretty straightforward. We do at least 3 years of treatment. We are waiting for the new clinical trial if we have to do 5 years. So we inform our patients that we do at least 3 years. We may extend to 5 years treatment after they are considered high risk for the size and the mitotic rate and so on. I think for the metastatic disease, GIST is probably the most impressive example of molecular changes and molecular escapes, because I think it's very critical for GIST tumors to be evaluated for c-KIT mutations, because c-KIT mutations are an incredible example how important the identification of the mutation in exon 9 and 11 is for dosing of your drug. Actually, one of the few examples we have that when you have an exon 9 mutation, you do the higher dose of imatinib and not the lower dose. Now, we are not only testing for c-kit mutation, we always test for PDGF receptor mutation, because we know when tumors escape imatinib treatment, there are two ways to do it. They either contain or develop mutation exon 14, 17, and 18 of c-kit, or in PDGF receptor mutations. Depending on what mutations grow out, your second-line treatment may depend on it, either regorafenib or sutinib, because they have different profiles of inhibiting this different new mutation. So I love GIST because it is a wonderful example how important molecular characterization of the tumor is for dosing of your drugs and the choice of second- and third-line treatments.
How do you approach second- and third-line therapy? And is there any role for nilotinib or dasatinib or other similar agents?
Yeah, so we usually do the molecular profiling, then use sunitinib or regorafenib based on the profile, but without the testing, because a lot of patients cannot afford or it's not possible, usually we use sunitinib followed by regorafenib as it is recommended. But dasatinib, sometimes actually VEGF inhibitors, mTOR inhibitors, there are some data they may have benefits, so we're trying to do that when they fail the treatments we have available in form of clinical trials. But there are interesting data on mTOR inhibitors, there are data on dasatinib, there are also data on anti-angiogenic treatments, because some of these tumors have an angiogenic rise. Now, I think very important for GIST patients' management is, because of all these different molecular features, they may have in one site the mutation, but not in another metastatic site. So you see a differential response in a liver met versus a peritoneal met or lung met or whatever. This is one of the opportunities when there is only one or two lesions growing to consider and talk to your surgeon to take this out, because there is a discordance of molecular makeup from different sites of metastasis for this disease. So it's important to consider surgical intervention, particularly when you have a very significant difference in response to the treatments you are giving the patient.
I'm curious what you see in terms of tolerability of second and third line therapy. I was going to ask you before, when you talked about TAS-102, what your experience is with, you mentioned the issues of side effects with regorafenib, particularly the hand-foot syndrome. What about in GIST?
Yeah, we have to do often dose modification, because I think what we are probably not realized, particular for imatinib and regorafenib and sunitinib, is these drugs are not highly toxic, but their side effect profiles is a grade 1 or grade 2 nausea and fatigue. And oncologists, we look for grade 3 toxicity. So we think, oh my God, if we see grade 3, that's bad. But our grade 3s are usually limited for a certain time in the treatment period. So usually at the first week of treatment, in the second week, the patients bounce back. Now, if you take oral medications and you have a grade 1 or grade 2 fatigue every single day, patients do not like that, because they never seem to get a break. They never get as sick as with the other treatments, but they also do not bounce back. And in our view of toxicity profiles, that may not become as apparent as the patients feel it. And I think that has been a learning process, particular with sunitinib and regorafenib, and also with imatinib, is that the patients, you know, complain about fatigue and they don't have the energy. And the skin, I don't think, is the major issue, but this chronic fatigue interferes with their daily activity more than when the patients would have FOLFOX and bevacizumab, where they get a couple of days very sick, but then have the second week to do their activities. And I think we still need to learn how to handle that and how that would dose modify, because our dose modification is all driven by grade 3 toxicities.
I want to maybe get a couple words from you about the way you approach patients with GI NET tumors particularly indications for systemic therapy and sequencing of it. I think you were part of a trial looking at bevacizumab and temsirolimus.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about your approach to these patients?
Yeah. So I think most of the tumors in the neuroendocrine field is for us the pancreatic cell tumors. So for this treatment options, I think for these patients, the spectrum and treatment armamentarium has changed over the last 5 years. And it's actually amazing what we have learned about the neuroendocrine tumors. We have now an NCI task force on neuroendocrine tumors, just paving the way of the better understanding and the molecular approaches. Now, I think with the mTOR inhibitor, as well as the anti-VEGF receptor inhibitors, have shown significant impact. And I think we are now able to control the disease without having the significant side effects of the classical cytotoxic we have used in the past. I think we moved on to that. I think we are still struggling. How do we develop more effective treatments combining targeted agents? And the clinical trial you're referring was actually a combination of an mTOR inhibitor and an bevacizumab. And this trial was amazing. Patients did extremely well with high response rate and significant impact on their control of the disease. So we were very excited when we were able to finally publish this data, because I think this is one of the first combinations of targeted agents in pancreatic islet cell tumors. Because with sunitinib or with an mTOR inhibitor alone, we don't see these high response rate, and sometimes with high volume disease, we would love to see tumor shrinkage in order to potentially also interfere surgically. Because neuroendocrine tumors are also one of the few diseases who benefit from potential debulking and taking out a massive amount of tumors, to tumor control leading the way to very focused tumor removal may actually have a significant impact on patients' outcome in the future. That's the reason I like a very effective regimen like the combination we just published.
I'm trying to think, wasn't there a phase 3 trial with Bev that was just presented?
Yes, that was actually a SWOG trial,
right.
Bevacizumab versus interferon, which was not a positive trial. I think anti-VHF alone may not be beneficial. I think we need to probably combine it, like in the trial with an mTOR inhibitor. I think always the question is, why do some tumors benefit from anti-VHF and others from anti-VHF receptors, you know, like the kidney cancers and the colon cancers. And here the neuroendocrine tumors seem to benefit much more from the TKIs targeting all the receptors. And I think the angiogenic areas and diseases which are more driven by VHLL or other underlying mechanism driving the receptors obviously may benefit more from TKIs than from the ligand-driven tumors such as the colon cancers.
So another kind of interesting new twist on attacking the biology of cancer that I've been hearing about for years, but now it kind of seems like it's maybe getting close to reality, are inhibitors of cancer stem cells. And I see that you've been involved with research on that. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the pathways involved, the agents that are out there, and what we know about that in gastric cancer, but also other cancers?
Yeah, so I think personally, I'm convinced the key of really massive success and potential cure of solid tumors are targeting the cancer stem cells. And I usually describe that for my fellows and residents, that cancer is like a tree. With cytotoxic chemotherapy and the new target agents, we are able to unleave a tree, cutting branches and maybe the stem. But we never able to unroot the tree. It always comes back. And the root of cancer are the stem cells. And they are by definition chemo-resistant. So we cannot kill cancer stem cells with classical chemo or even targeted agents. So how can we approach or target the pathways involved in stem cell signaling? And we know and have identified the major pathway, which is Wnt signaling, Notch, as well as TGF-beta. So we know a little bit about these pathways. The problem is stem cell signaling pathways are complex. So when we look at the Wnt pathway, it's extremely important to understand. You cannot just inhibit the pathway because this pathway is responsible for proliferation of cancer and differentiation. So when you inhibit both, you will experience a lot of toxicities. So many drugs to inhibit this pathway did not reach further development because clinically or preclinically it was seen to have significant toxicity. So we have to become much smarter in the future. Now, there are drugs developed by many different companies targeting the Wnt signaling pathway, including the receptors for Wnt, which is Frizzl or Dickopf, which is part of the further downstream signaling, or CBP-catenin. And there are in clinical trials for colon cancer, pancreas cancer, leukemias, cholangiocarcinoma. So we see now the introduction of these new drugs really focusing to target these stem cells in clinical trial development. Because the goal of these new drugs is to differentiate out the stem cells and then kill it with chemotherapy. Otherwise, we will not succeed.
Any clinical evidence at this point in terms of efficacy, and also you mentioned in terms of the issue of tolerability issues with these stem cell inhibitors?
Yes, so there is. We actually did one of the first in class, first trial, human trial, a CPP-catenin inhibitor called PRI-724. We presented that in an oral presentation at ASCO, not last year, the year before. And what we were able to show is that we could completely eliminate cancer stem cells. But it was a single agent trial, which I don't think will show the full benefit of these CPP-catenin. Just to differentiate out stem cells is not enough. We need to kill them with chemotherapy when differentiated. But we clearly could monitor the efficacy of this drug by monitoring the molecular changes of circulating tumor cells. And this is well documented, and we showed some clinical potential benefit. That's the reason this drug is now in combination with chemo in colon and in pancreas cancer. Now, because this is not inhibiting the full pathway, we did not see any toxicity.
Now, is this similar? I see that you had a poster at this ASCO meeting on an agent called BBI-608. And I also see that there was another trial in progress poster on that agent, a phase 3 randomized double-blind study in gastric cancer with paclitaxel.
Yeah, so the BBI component is actually a very interesting component because it actually targets also cancer stem cells, but it has a different target. So we show very early clinical efficacy with this drug in combination with taxanes in the phase 2 studies. But now, because of the preliminary data, it's now in a phase 3. The target is here is the STAT pathway, which is also linked to stem cell development. So I think we're seeing from different angles that targeting the stem cell may be a way to further increase the efficacy, but I think always in combination with cytotoxic treatments.